From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe has stepped down. Last week, the White House denied a report in the New York Times that a month after President Trump fired then-FBI Director James Comey, Trump asked Comey's deputy McCabe, who he voted for. McCabe said he didn't vote. And McCabe has long been a Twitter target of the president's. Critics have wondered if that is interference in the Russia investigation, which McCabe ran for a time. Also, the State of the Union is tomorrow. As the president swore in his new Health and Human Services Secretary today, he took a moment to preview his speech, which he said will address an immigration deal lawmakers are hammering out.
For many years, they've been talking immigration. They never got anything done. We're going to get something done. We hope. It's got to be bipartisan, because the Republicans really don't have the votes to get it done in any other way. So it has to be bipartisan. But hopefully the Democrats will join us, or enough of them will join us, so we can really do something great.
Asked if he's inviting Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer back to the White House for negotiations, the president said, "We might." NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Domenico, start with McCabe stepping down. Not a surprise in that he'd indicated he would retire. But where does this leave the Trump tweet attacks on him, or, you know, the president's questioning about his voting?
Well, no, this is not a surprise, given the fact that McCabe was supposed to resign at some point this year. He's eligible for retirement in March. But the announcement did come abruptly. NPR's Kerry Johnson confirmed that McCabe is stepping down today. One source called it basically a done deal now. And McCabe, for months, has been subjected to, tweet attacks from President Trump. There have been at least five very pointed Twitter attacks from the president, calling out McCabe's wife for having run as a Democrat and having donated money to Democratic campaigns. McCabe himself voted in the Republican primary in 2016, but not in the general election, apparently. Yeah. So, you know, this is going to mean McCabe is somebody who was a career official who was looking for, was becoming retirement eligible in March. And everyone expected that at some point early this year that this would become effective and that he would at least stay on, even if it's in a temporary leave position through March, which is what's happening.
Well, I guess the question is, it's speculation, but will the president questioning an official about his voting record or attacking him on Twitter, will that be part of what critics say is witness intimidation or, an attempt to derail the investigation?
Well, it's certainly a question that's going to be raised. You know, the president also the Washington Post reported yesterday that the president was wondering why he couldn't, influence my guys at the Trump Justice Department, as he called it. So, there is definitely a blowing up of what the normal processes are, what the protocols are. And depending on that line, and I'm not exactly sure the legal line on this, we know that the Mueller investigation is at least looking into the possibility of obstruction of justice. And James Comey, the fired FBI director, certainly was laying a trail for Mueller during his testimony on Capitol Hill and has shared his memos with Mueller.
Well, later today, lawmakers could vote to release that controversial Republican memo alleging FBI surveillance abuse of the Trump campaign. Democrats say it's got cherry-picked information just to discredit the FBI. So they've renewed a push for a law to protect FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller from being fired. But in an interview on ABC's This Week, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham seemed to disagree.
I see no evidence that President Trump wants to fire Mr. Mueller now. It's pretty clear to me that everybody in the White House knows it'd be the end of the President Trump's presidency if he fired Mr. Mueller. So I think we're in a good spot with Mr. Mueller.
Well, back in August, though, when people were hearing about this speculation that Trump had tried to fire Mueller, Republicans were more on board with a law to protect him. What's changed?
Well, Republicans are split on whether or not they think there's a necessity to pass a law to say that they could protect Mueller. Maybe if there were rumors or speculation that started to crop up that the president was thinking about doing this again, that might push them in a different direction. But at this point, they've showed no willingness to say that they're going to put something on the table or think that that's necessary. Yeah. So let's see where that goes right now. And certainly impeachment is off the table as a Republican Congress controls Congress. So, you know, these kinds of questions are more likely to be settled with this year's elections.
Look, we only got less than a minute, but the president's inaugural was bleak and nationalistic. He spoke of ending the American carnage. What do you expect tomorrow?
Well, look, the president has a lot to tout. The economy is doing well. Mm-hmm. The U.S. isn't in a hot war that where you're seeing mounting American troop deaths. But he has low approval rating, no health care plan, no immigration plan. He's had a divisive presidency. I would expect that he tries to appear calm, scripted, you know, that sort of measured tone with bipartisan overtures, because he knows this is going to be one of the biggest audiences of his presidency, certainly his biggest one of the year. More than 47.5 million people tuned in to the State of the Union or to the joint the address to joint Congress last year. So I would expect that again.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, on Election Day back in November, Democrats flipped 15 seats in the Virginia legislature. 11 of those seats were won by women. Patrick Madden from member station WAMU caught up with some of them in Richmond during their first few days at the Capitol.
It was a historic swearing in.
I solemnly swear that I'll support the Constitution.
More women, more diversity than ever before.
I was surprised by the overwhelming sense of emotions I had.
Kathy Tran is a new delegate to the legislature from Fairfax County, a Virginia suburb.
Looking around this room and how much more diverse it is and how much more representative it is of our communities and the small piece that I'll have to play in our state's history.
Tran's office at the Capitol could double as a daycare center. The room is filled with toys, bottles, a rocker, and a baby.
This is Elise, and she's sleeping right now.
How old is she?
She is 11 months.
Tran takes Elise everywhere with her. She campaigned with her, knocking on doors across Fairfax, and now she's brought her to Richmond. Tran is one of the first Asian American state lawmakers and the first Vietnamese American ever to serve in the Virginia legislature.
There's some things that are unique to Asian Americans and to Vietnamese Americans and refugees and immigrants and working moms. And there's some things that are just really common. Like, we all want health care and we want good public education systems. We want good jobs. And we want to be able to get there on time.
Tran isn't the only trailblazer among this new group of Democratic lawmakers dubbed the Freshman 15. The first lesbian candidate won. The first Latinas were sworn in, including Elizabeth Guzman from Prince William County, also in Northern Virginia.
Me personally, I was told that Virginia was not ready to have a delegate who looks like me. And look what happened.
And there's Danica Rome, the first ever transgender woman elected to state office in Virginia.
A lot of women are very capable at seeking common ground and then actually making it happen. I think that's what we're going to show, that by having a lot more women's voices represented.
But it's not going to be easy. Republicans still control the House of Delegates and have a large say over what gets done.
The House will come to order. The delegate from Fairfax, Delegate Watts.
Day two of the General Assembly began with a speech. Democrat Vivian Watts, a longtime delegate from Fairfax, stood before the packed chamber and celebrated the 28 women sworn in.
We didn't crack the ceiling, we shattered it.
Watts was first elected in 1982. There were only a handful of women in the Virginia House at the time. Watts had been one of Fairfax County's top economic development officials. She was a tax expert, a whiz on incentive packages, and then she became a lawmaker.
My biggest challenge was first and foremost to be taken seriously.
She fought to get on the Finance Committee, which had never had a woman on it because it had been considered a man's issue.
I'm sure many women have experienced this. You have offered the solution. It doesn't get picked up for about 5-10 minutes until a guy says it, and then, okay, that's where we're going.
She ended up helping solve a big tax crisis, but she also remembers dealing with a lot of nonsense.
And I'm not going to identify who said this to me. I think he meant me well. But he said to me, Vivian, you made a big mistake up there. You acted smart.
Day three, and the real work begins. Lawmakers, aides, and House pages scurry around the Capitol, trying to get to the early morning committee meetings. Kathy Tran is holding her baby, Elise.
I'm really excited to be on this committee and to tackle issues like gerrymandering and breaking down barriers to voting. So I'm really excited.
Republican Delegate Mark Cole gavels the meeting to order and gets ready to hand out the subcommittee assignments.
You know, I spent a lot of time working on this last night, and I came up with what I thought was a great plan that would have made everybody happy. Unfortunately, I left that on my nightstand this morning.
And Republicans break out in laughter. The atmosphere at this Southern State House can seem at times like an old boys club. But this group of freshman female Democrats say they're ready to get to work. Jennifer Carroll Foy, who represents Prince William County, was one of the first female graduates from the Virginia Military Institute.
Being in a room where some people may not want you there, and they may think different than you, they may come from different socioeconomic status, different backgrounds, but at the end of the day, you have to plan and execute. You all have a job to get done.
For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Madden.
In Egypt, President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi seems poised to be re-elected in March. There will only be one other candidate on the ballot. Sisi was elected president in 2014 after leading the military coup that ousted President Mohamed Morsi, the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. Three other men who were going to challenge Sisi's re-election bid had dropped out of the race before today's registration deadline, and some opposition leaders are calling for a boycott of the election. Joining us now is NPR's Jane Arraf. She's in Cairo, and she joins us on Skype. Jane, tell us more about the man who is going to challenge President el-Sisi. Who is he?
Well, his name is Mustafa Musa, but the thing we really need to know about him, I guess, is he's probably not really a challenge to the president. And that's because he heads this party called Ba'ath, the Tomorrow Party, which up until just a few hours ago had actually been supporting Sisi. So if you looked on his Facebook page, you would have seen these big posts saying that they supported President Sisi for re-election. But with just a few hours before the deadline today, he actually declared his own candidacy. Those statements of support for Sisi went off, and now he is the candidate, the one who's running against the president.
And why did those three other candidates drop out?
So there were actually four, and then another one way before. So two of them were arrested, which is a pretty good reason to be dropping out. One of them was a former military chief of staff, and he was actually charged with incitement against the military. And military prosecutors said because he hadn't fully retired, he wasn't allowed to run. So he's now been detained. Another one was also, the rest of them basically said that they had been intimidated, their supporters had been harassed, they were worried about the safety of their campaign workers. And then there's a lawyer, Khaled Ali, who actually is facing conviction. He has been convicted, and he's appealing a charge of making an obscene gesture. So for a variety of reasons, they've either been detained, arrested, or pretty much been pressured to drop out.
If any of them had been able to run, though, would they have been a real challenge to el-Sisi, or is he kind of unbeatable?
Well, that's a great question. Unbeatable probably is the way it's going to play out, but that makes him sound much more popular than he actually is. Not that he isn't popular. There are a lot of people who think he is just what the country needs. But there are a lot of other people who, given some choices, wouldn't vote for Sisi. They'd vote for someone who delivered more in the way of freedoms and human rights and all of the things that people took to the streets in protest for when they launched the peaceful revolution that toppled a dictator here. So the bottom line is this just isn't the atmosphere for an election in which there are a lot of candidates, in which there's a real opposition. And that's not what people are expecting, really.
Well, what has el-Sisi done for the economy in Egypt, which has been struggling so much for so many years now since the Arab Spring? Has he been able to make things better for people?
He has made some things better, and there are quite a few business people who are relatively happy with him. That's because he adopted some very painful reforms that were directed by the International Monetary Fund to bail Egypt out of a huge financial crisis. Those reforms plunged people who were poor into even more poverty. But what they have done is they've stabilized the currency. They've stemmed the flow of currency out of here. They've attracted a bit more investment. tourism is picking up a little bit. So all of those indicators look a little bit better, and people believe that the economy will be better, but people are still desperately poor. So there are signs of light on the horizon, but it hasn't quite kicked in yet for ordinary Egyptians.
And what about the promise of democracy? You mentioned the Arab Spring. It was 7 years ago this month, huge crowds in Tahrir Square, and they didn't like having an authoritarian ruler in Hosni Mubarak. They wanted real democracy. It sounds, from what we're hearing about this upcoming election, that that has not happened.
No, it hasn't exactly happened, and there are a lot of reasons for that. And, you know, it was such a heady time that the thought that you could actually get people out in peaceful protest and it would create this massive change, which it did for a time. But then you talk to people who are leaders of that revolution and they say their revolution was hijacked. And there are a number of reasons for that as well. But the bottom line is we're looking at a political climate here where the president was at the head of a military coup that toppled an elected leader. Now, he was an elected leader who was becoming increasingly authoritarian. His party, the Muslim Brotherhood, is now banned. And there are thousands of people arrested, thousands of political prisoners. There is virtually no freedom. The country is under martial law. So all of that, a lot of that promise has gone away. That doesn't mean it won't come back. But this isn't really a climate where people who believed in real change are expecting change anytime soon.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf joining us from Cairo, Egypt. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, a Daily Beast journalist says he can see jogging activity near a suspected CIA base in Somalia. At a special ops outpost in the Syrian desert, someone is running in a perfect oblong around the compound. In Afghanistan, you can see where someone else is walking a possible supply route. The information can be seen on the global heat map published by the GPS tracking company Strava last November. The company used satellite data from 2015 to 2017 to show where people are using fitness devices. But an alert young man in Australia recently noticed that the map also shows where U.S. troops are, often in sensitive places, and the military is now responding. Adam Ronsley with The Daily Beast is following this. And Adam, you're the one who found the jogging activity on a beach in Somalia?
Yes. If you look at the map, you can go to known sites and sites that aren't quite known. And you can see patterns of activity running around a beach. There's a CIA facility that was reported in The Nation at the airport in Mogadishu. And you can see some folks around there have been doing a lot of exercise and working up a sweat on the beach.
Right. You can see them in another place in Syria where it's thought the U.S. might be building a base. And you can see the light of the fitness devices lighting up as they run across a dam. How's the military responding to this?
The military is saying they are going to, quote unquote, refine their social media policies and their operational security policies. They had actually encouraged people to be using Fitbits, which are a fitness tracking wristband that you can use to track your steps, track your runs, in order to get more exercise. But now they're finding that people took that advice and people took their exercise tracking abilities a little too far and went around tracking their activity when they were downrange in very, very, very sensitive places.
Well, it's not just the jogging that you can see. And by the way, you know, the whole mainland United States just lights up like a Christmas
yes.
tree because it's just everybody's using them everywhere. The reason that you can find these U.S. troops and Russian troops as well in Syria, for instance, mm-hmm. is because it's so isolated. It's so rare to see the lights, for instance, in Syria. But it's not just jogging activity. You can see where troops are, you know, eating in a mess hall because they still have the Fitbit on.
Well, even more importantly, and what freaks out a lot of military folks that I've spoken to, is the fact that, you know, people are wearing these apparently on patrol as they walk around and drive around isolated bases in combat zones in Syria and Afghanistan. And that kind of data is data that an insurgent or a terrorist would really, really, really like to have because that establishes a pattern of life outside that base.
Yeah.
That allows them to understand who's where, when, where likely routes are that they could implant an IED, where likely routes are that they could carry out an ambush. And that's something that has a lot of people very unnerved.
Well, it's horrifying. And, you know, more so for those who might be a target like the troops. But what's the average person supposed to take from this? You've been hearing from security experts all weekend as this map got noticed first by this young man and then by everyone.
Yes, I got a lot of panic text messages this weekend. But, you know, the average person probably doesn't have that much to worry about. But it's a good reminder that, you know, you are carrying around a microphone, a camera, and a tracker, and you're paying the bill for it. Mm-hmm. And that data can be used in ways that you did not expect and did not anticipate. And you need to think very, very hard and do an audit of your privacy and the apps that you use, because they can reveal things that you are not necessarily aware of.
Back to the military, though. Now that this is out, it's sort of, you know, out of the bottle. How does the military put it back in?
I think, you know, they have to. The military obviously does a lot of operational security training and awareness, but humans are humans, and they tend to ignore that. Cell phones are very convenient. We're all glued to our devices. But they have to get tough about telling people not to take these things in particularly sensitive places. You know, Camp Peary in Virginia, where the CIA reportedly trains new clandestine service officers, is not a place you should be bringing a phone, much less uploading your latest workout.
And by the way, when you mentioned you're getting calls from security analysts, obviously you can't share with us some of the information that they are panicked about. But this is pretty widespread. I mean, people are fearful of some of this information.
Yes, and it's just sort of the tip of the iceberg, because, you know, we're only just seeing this now because Strava chose to make this data available in a heat map, which makes it pretty convenient to see. But I think some of the fears are that, you know, this may just be the tip of the iceberg, is that if people have been, you know, have been careless about bringing their cell phones or bringing internet-connected devices or tracking devices into sensitive areas, what other apps have they been using? What other devices have they been bringing where they shouldn't?
Yeah. Adam Ronsley of the Daily Beast, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
So, does this make you think twice about your Fitbit? Thoughts welcome, hereandnow.org.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
The value of the U.S. dollar has fallen about 11% against global currencies in the last year. And last week at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said a weaker dollar is good for U.S. trade. That goes against longstanding U.S. policy and the words of his own boss. Here's President Trump speaking on Thursday.
We are doing so well. Our country is becoming so economically strong again, and strong in other ways, too, by the way, that the dollar is going to get stronger and stronger. And ultimately, I want to see a strong dollar.
Mnuchin said that his comments were taken out of context. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. She joins us. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And let's start with the upside here. What did Steve Mnuchin mean when he said a weak dollar is good in some ways, even though he now says his comments were taken out of context?
Yeah, they weren't taken out of context. He just actually said something that most officials don't acknowledge, and that is when the value of the dollar falls, it does make U.S. exports cheaper. So, you know, again, if you think about what do we export, say a Boeing airplane, it becomes a cheaper option for Europeans who may otherwise buy, say, a European-made Airbus plane. Mm-hmm. And the result is really good for U.S. manufacturers and exporters. It can also improve the trade balance. Of course, conversely, for those who, like me, who drink too much imported scotch, we may want to switch to domestic bourbon because that's going to be cheaper as the dollar falls. It doesn't matter if it's made in Kentucky, but it does matter if it is made in the Highlands.
What has been causing the dollar to decline in value?
Yeah, I mean, it's really sort of confounding because, remember, last year we had three Federal Reserve interest rate hikes. And, you know, what's really usually occurring is that when we have central bank tightening with solid economic growth, That usually does strengthen the currency. It's not what has happened this time. And lots of different explanations. But the one that seems most prevalent when I talk to economists is they say, look, growth in Europe and Japan have improved much more than expected in the last year or so. That has prompted the central banks in those areas to shift from their very loose monetary policy to somewhat tighter policy. It's made those currencies more desirable than the greenback.
So why does the U.S. have this longstanding strong dollar policy if there are upsides to a weak dollar?
Yeah, I think this comes from the 90s. And people don't probably remember that 1994 was a really bad year for bond investors. There were some crazy currency things that were going on. Then Secretary of State, Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, he basically started talking about this thing called the strong dollar policy. And I think it was just meant to discourage other countries from devaluing their currencies to gain that competitive edge. And since then, this so-called strong dollar policy, it's consisted, but it's really just statements by the government. It hasn't really translated into specific actions. And so that's really what you need to know when they say talk up the dollar, talk down the dollar. It's just yammering. It doesn't really mean they've done anything.
Jill, I'm a Macallan person myself when we're talking about scotch.
That is why we get along so well here.
Why do we keep meeting for coffee? We need to go out for a drink. Jill Schlesinger, a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
President Trump delivers his first State of the Union address tomorrow night, and we're going to hear from a number of voices ahead of that speech. Today, someone who is very happy with President Trump. Joining us now is Randall Schweller, professor of political science at Ohio State University in Columbus. Professor, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And you joined us a year ago on Inauguration Day. As you look back at the first year of the Trump presidency, how would you say he's done?
Very well. I'm very happy with it. There might be a couple things I would do differently, but I think on the whole, he's following through on his campaign promises.
What would the things that you would like him to do differently be?
Well, to focus on the negative, I think ramping up Afghanistan, putting more troops in Afghanistan doesn't seem wise to me, but then I'm not privy to all the information that the military has. But I think this is something we should try to get out of.
And in fact, President Trump had said the same thing years ago before he was president. Let's listen to him in 2011 talking about President Obama and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I think he could have gotten out a long time ago. These wars are a disaster. Iraq is going to be taken over by Iran the minute we leave.
So why do you think President Trump has reversed course on that? And now he's, in fact, sending more troops to Afghanistan.
I think he's just listening to the generals. And, you know, if you look at his cabinet, he has a great deal of respect for the military and doesn't like too much civilian intervention.
What are the other things that you think that he could do better?
I guess he could stop tweeting so much. That's probably the most important thing.
Well, on the issue of his foreign policy, what do you think the Trump doctrine is, or is there one?
Oh, there is no Trump doctrine yet. I don't even think there was an Obama doctrine. And those kind of things usually come late in a president's term. But if I had to say what the spirit of Trumpism is, it would be kind of a return to realist principles of you do things when they're in the national interest, narrowly defined, and you weigh all of your agreements and treaty obligations and commitments according to – and that includes trade agreements particularly according to how will they affect America's interests and how will they affect the American people, which after all, the government is to serve the American people.
You think it's in the national interest for President Trump to slap tariffs on solar panels and washing machines coming out of China when it could mean retaliation from China?
Yes. Those are that you mentioned one of the other things that I'm not thrilled about. But I am not in principle against tariffs if it will level the playing field or if you use them as bargaining chips to get fair trade. We all want free trade, but as it stands, the United States is running trade deficits of almost $48 billion a month, much of it with China and Mexico. And so we have to do something to get fair trade, because I do not believe that if we had the same kind of access to their markets as they have to our markets, that you would see these incredibly large trade deficits that have been persistent for many, many, many years.
Well, you say we all want free trade. Do you think President Trump wants free trade? Because he who knows what will happen with NAFTA now? He wants to renegotiate it. But in terms of the TPP, he took the U.S. out of that deal.
Again, I think it's because it wasn't fair to the U.S. And NAFTA is run, it's been great for creating a Mexican middle class, just like our deals with China. But it's done very little for American middle class and American workers. And so we like free trade, but we're running $300 billion worth of deficits with Mexico every year. And I don't think that that's a good thing for Americans.
I want to ask you about ISIS. The president offered a preview of what he might say in his speech in Davos on Friday. He said America is open for business, and he said this about the fight against ISIS.
I am pleased to report that the coalition to defeat ISIS has retaken almost 100% of the territory once held by these killers in Iraq and Syria.
What do you think of the president's fight against ISIS?
I think he's winning the fight against ISIS, which is a good thing. And I mean, even the New York Times had to say, you know, if anyone had predicted that ISIS would hold virtually no territory at all a year after Trump was elected, that's a huge accomplishment, a huge achievement. And you had, you know, it rarely makes the mainstream media. You don't see CNN talking about it. You don't see MSNBC. You don't see NBC. They talk about, you know, a fake Russia collusion scandal 24/7.
Why do you say a fake Russian collusion scandal? We haven't heard yet from, you know, from Robert Mueller
because
what the
I'll tell you all that. I would love to go on this. Okay, so why is it fake? Well, let's do a counterfactual. Imagine that Hillary Clinton had won the election. Do you think we would talk about Russian collusion or Russian meddling in our election for a year and a half, virtually 24/7? Would that be what CNN's sole narrative would be? MSNBC's sole narrative, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, they would barely be talking about it because they'd know that it had nothing to do with the election. And, it, you know, they didn't overturn one precinct. The question, the counterfactual, would we be talking about this if Hillary had won? No. I mean, do you honestly think that we would be talking about Russia 24/7, Russia collusion, if Hillary Clinton had won the election?
Well, part of the story, though, is that Russia wanted Trump to win the election. And so if Hillary had won, that wouldn't have been what they had been trying to do.
So then you are saying that you do believe that the Russians have succeeded in putting Trump in the White House.
I'm not saying that at all. No, I'm
well,
just saying
two
that
different
that's
questions.
But I think that's an important part of the story. The if Russia was meddling in our elections and they wanted one party to win and that party did win, then you would look into that more than if they didn't succeed in getting the person that they wanted elected in
but
office.
But they're two different questions. And I'm saying Russia had zero effect in the American election. I'm not saying they didn't try to do things. I'm just saying they had no effect whatsoever. We do things all the time in other people's elections. If they had actually affected ballot boxes, okay, now that's an issue. But that's not what happened. So if Hillary had won, we wouldn't be talking about this. So you're saying the fact that they wanted Trump to win means – and Trump won – now we should talk about it 24/7 relentlessly and say we were attacked by Russia. They've weaponized information. Things we would never be talking about if Hillary had won. So it's just all sour grapes.
Well, we don't talk about it 24/7. I can
guarantee
that.
No, you don't. That is true.
So do you think Trump should talk about it at all during the State of the Union? Should he bring up the Russia investigation?
I wouldn't personally, but I'm not Trump. I think he will, but – you know, I think whatever he wants to do, he seems to know what the American people want to hear, at least a good portion. Obviously, not half the country. They can't stand him. But, you know, he'll probably talk about whatever he wants to talk. Trump will be Trump.
What do you say to people who might be listening to you talk about President Trump and the State of the Union who think this person is living on a totally different planet than I am? And I don't think that any of these things that Trump has done are good.
So killing ISIS is bad, I guess. Cleaning up the regulatory environment is bad. We expect 4% growth in 2018. We have American companies repatriating profits, giving their employees $1,000 bonuses, stock options. The stock market has gone from 18,000 the Dow to about 26,500. That's like a 33% increase. All the good things that Trump has done would. If these had gone the other direction, let's say ISIS has taken more territory. Let's say the stock market, instead of going up 6,000 points, had gone down 6,000
points.
Well, wait.
Let's talk about the stock market for 1 second, because it went up a lot under President Obama, and President Trump attacked him and said he wasn't doing a good job with the economy. If he's going to take credit for the stock market, why shouldn't any credit have gone to President Obama?
Obama did get plenty of credit for bringing the stock market back, but come on, in 1 year, the stock market's up from 18,000 to 26,000. When people like Krugman and others said, and Pelosi and others said that the stock market would crash when Trump was elected, she called the tax cuts Armageddon. I mean, they're living in the alternative reality, not me. I mean, anyone that doesn't see that the stock market at this rate, the stock market will be at 100,000 by the time he leaves office. I mean, yes, it grew under Obama, but to say that these are the effects of Obama economy, believe me, if it had tanked, they would have blamed Trump. So if the stock market had gone down 6,000, they blame Trump. But if it goes up 6,000, they say it's Obama. So this is like if you're a witch, you know, if you sink, you're a human. If you float, you're a witch.
That's Randall Schweller, who is a professor of political science at Ohio State University, talking with us about the president and the State of the Union address, which is tomorrow. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Technologies like 3D printing are having a big impact on construction and manufacturing, and there's an industrial workshop in Boston where researchers are experimenting with new design techniques that could transform the way stuff is made, from robo-furniture that can reconfigure itself to fit your needs to shelters for astronauts on Mars. Bruce Gellerman from member station WBUR checked it out.
2 years ago, California design software company Autodesk set up shop in Boston's Innovation District with some innovative ideas of its own. Rick Rundell is senior director at the Build Space Industrial Workshop.
What we're doing here is designed to look forward beyond the incremental, over the horizon, where we can't see yet.
And here we go.
Stephanie Pender, shop supervisor, starts up a high-powered water jet at the Build Space.
Material that it won't go through. I think it will cut anything.
The water jet shoots out a stream of ground-up garnet and water at 87,000 pounds per square inch, enough power to slice through glass, steel, even titanium. The water jet is just one of dozens of state-of-the-art machine tools in the 34,000 square foot Build space. Build is an acronym for Building, Innovation, Learning, and Design. It's a place where, for a few months, competitively selected tech teams get unlimited access to specialized software, expensive equipment, expertise, and workspace at no cost. Here, entrepreneurs like Sevat Sodikov, founder of Medicom Inc., are free to explore the limits of their industrial design imaginations.
We're humbly trying to resolve world problems.
The Medicom company is trying to automate the process to turn corrugated cardboard, tossed into the trash, into a super strong, sustainable building material.
What you're looking at here is a high-performance, relatively inexpensive panel that is sourced and manufactured locally to be consumed locally.
At a workspace next to Medicom is a builder-in-residence who turned personal necessity into the mother of a new invention. Meeting Braden Leonard, founder of Handmade Prosthetics, was a little awkward. I had to shake his left hand.
What happened to your arm?
I got in an accident. I got a flesh-eating bacterial infection, and I ended up going into a coma, and they had to amputate in order for me to survive. So
you woke up?
I woke up with a surprise, yeah.
Leonard, a Rhode Island firefighter, turned inventor when he learned the hard way that fitting artificial arms and attaching them to the body with a socket has changed little in decades.
I'm not moving my arm right now, but can you see? You had a lot of movement.
Yeah, I can hear it squeak.
Yeah. So this movement isn't getting transferred. Turn that wrist over now, so there's that lag.
Leonard is designing a new process to update the prosthetic arm attachment system.
We're trying to take a different approach and trying to capture some more of the anatomical movement that you naturally have that sometimes gets lost when you wear a socket.
Leonard's goal is to go from scanned image of an amputee's arm to computerized custom design to finished 3D printed product using a plant-based plastic. Nearby at another build workspace, an electronic whistling sound is produced by a different kind of arm at work.
The technical term for this would be a serial link micro-macro manipulator arm. We call it a construction robot.
Julian Bell puts the huge digital construction platform through its paces. Bell is with MIT's Media Lab, where the giant 33-foot-long autonomous arm mounted on a maneuverable platform was created. It's twice the size and costs a lot less than its nearest competitor.
With this project, we're really looking at going to a much larger scale. We're looking at taking these tools and techniques that we've developed in our labs, in our machine shops, and scaling them up to architectural scales.
This new class of architectural robot, powered by solar, can drive autonomously to a work site, clear the area, and construct the building faster, better, cheaper, using a 3D printing process. Recently, this robo-builder made a 50-foot diameter, 12-foot-high dome structure in 14 hours, all by itself. The building could be used to store road salt or be a home away from home on Mars.
NASA's actually sponsoring a program right now to look into that.
Closer to home, the company Ori Systems is using robotics to bring the price of rental space down to Earth.
So look at this. This is an example of it's a studio apartment.
At the Build Lab, Ori CEO Asiya Larea shows off a small furnished room. He says in some cities, a tiny place like this might go for $3,000 a month.
What we do is basically say, look, people want to have a queen-size bed, people want to have a walk-in closet, people want to have an office, but if you only have 200, 300, 400 square feet, you just cannot have all of that.
But with Ori Systems' smart movable furniture, you can have it all, on command. Tiny robots transform the space into different functions. Alexa, I'm sleepy.
What you can do is give someone a bedroom when they need it, give them a walk-in closet when they need it, or open up a living room when they need it. So think about programmable spaces.
Think future. That's what Build Space is all about, creating a crystal ball community of inventors working with limits and going beyond. For Here and Now, I'm Bruce Geller.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.